This is a special Trenches Technology podcast series with your host, Sharon Bueno, managing editor of Trenches Technology Magazine. We're celebrating 50 years of horizontal directional drilling. 2021 marks the golden anniversary for horizontal directional drilling, better known as HDD. What started out as a 500-foot crossing pulling 4-inch pipe under the Pajaro River in Northern California has evolved into a multi-billion dollar global industry. Horizontal directional drilling is critical to the installation of water, sewer, natural gas, electric, telecom, and fiber lines around the world. Our first episode of this special three-part HDD at 50 Trenches Technology podcast featured the father of HDD, Martin Charrington. In this episode, we feature another HDD pioneer, Dr. John Mercer, who is responsible for creating walkover locating. John has degrees in electrical engineering as well as advanced degrees and a PhD in aeronautical engineering. He once worked for the Boeing Aircraft Company after he graduated in its research group. He later joined a company called Flomol and was tasked with developing a means to install cables and conduits underground in residential areas. He conceived and developed the guide drill, which had a contoured head for steering and a dipole transmitter in the head for accurate locating using existing cable locators. All of this created a new avenue for HDD to expand its reach. Using his aeronautical engineering background, John replaced azimuth, elevation, and tool face angle with yaw, pitch, and roll, terms the HDD industry has adopted. He left Flomol in 1988 and went on to found his own company, Digital Control Incorporated, right from his bedroom. The product he developed was a novel locator specifically designed for HDD and eliminated the issue of ghost signals produced by cable locators. It also introduced a new way of calculating depth. He was joined by Peter Hambling in 1991, and the rest is history with DCI and its place in HDD lore. In this episode, John shares with us those early days with Flomol and how the small diameter utility HDD market segment got its start. He also talked about how he later focused on the locating side of horizontal directional drilling and how he came to develop walkover locating, an essential and key component on the HDD job site. Here's my conversation with John Mercer.
Hey, John, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, good to have you. As you know, HDD, horizontal directional drilling, has reached 50. What are your thoughts on this milestone for the industry?
It's really hard to believe it's been 50 years. On the other hand, a lot has been accomplished in those 50 years. The industry has gone from specialized drilling requiring huge equipment to perform a job to where it's just everywhere. It's operating in all different types of conditions, from small utilities all the way up to big pipelines. And it's gone from sort of cherry picking jobs in soft soils to being able to work in all different kinds of access conditions. And I think the big thing is become an international business. You're just as likely to see an HDD rig in Bangladesh as you are in Chicago. And that's absolutely amazing that HDD has become so widely accepted.
When we first talked for the story in April, you were very quick to point out you were not there. You have not been in the industry 50 years.
No, I have not. I picked it up, let's see, 84. So it's come up for almost 40 years, 36 years, 37 years, actually 37 years this month.
Oh, happy anniversary to you. But you are considered one of the pioneers to the industry for your work and what you've contributed. I mean, that's pretty cool to be considered a pioneer for such a industry that we have.
Well, it is hard to believe, and thank you for putting me in that category. I appreciate that. When I joined Flomol, that was in 1984, they asked me for a way to install electrical cables. They were working predominantly on distribution cables. And without a way of cutting the surface, didn't require cutting the surface, essentially a trenchless technique. And I just wouldn't believe that it's grown to such an incredible market. I'm really honored to be considered a pioneer in that market. It is amazing.
I mean, your name gets mentioned with the ones that's like the Martin Charringtons, the Dick Melsheimers, the Ed Melzons. of the world. Who were some of the people you remember early on?
Well, you know, when I got into this business, I was not involved in any of the HDD type work. Mm-hmm. I was putting up wind turbines in, and we were, most of them wound up in California and Alderman Pass and Tehachapi. And I was working for the parent company of Flowmol, which was Flow Research. And my background was in electrical and aeronautical engineering, so I was not doing that work. But I had kind of come up with some, you know, products, inventions in Flow Research, high pressure water jet cutting, mm-hmm. and those things. And basically, I was asked to join Flowmol when they started it, shortly after they started it, to come up with this idea of how to put, you know, product in the ground without needing a trench. And I think Martin Charrington's name was mentioned, and I heard a little bit about him, but I wasn't, really too familiar with his work until we started to get patents, and I found some of his inventions. But I think one of the engineers that had been working in this area on a contract from the Electric Power Research had some idea of what Charrington had done. And he was trying to use a piece of just plain pipe with a bend in it and a nozzle mm-hmm. in the end of the pipe. And he was connecting that pipe through a water swivel, so we could pump water into the pipe, to a two-man drill. It was a hydraulically operated drill and required two people to hang on to it. And it was a test to see if we could steer something like that without, you know, a mud motor on the end, just a pipe with a jet. Well, we proved that it would steer, but it vibrated so badly, it broke the pipe. And so I knew that wasn't a good way to do it. I think one of the things that what came out of it when I looked at the Charrington patent was that he had this arcuate drilling. And I think it was similar to what this fellow was trying to do, only it had a mud motor with a bent sub. And his idea was that you would put the drill into the ground at a certain angle, and the bent sub would cause it to curve upward. And then when you got to the middle of the river, it would continue upward and come up out of the ground on the other side. And I think this was an attempt at simulating that with just a bent pipe and a nozzle. I knew that idea with just a jet wasn't going to work. And so I move on to something that would work. And but it gave me some ideas. Mm-hmm. So I think Charrington had an influence that I didn't really know it was Charrington at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's certainly a pioneer. I mean, he's kind of the first one in this mm-hmm. industry.
You came at it from not even being in construction, really.
Right.
So you had a different maybe perspective to offer when you're looking mm-hmm. at a way to do it.
I think that's correct, because I've been working on flow analysis, you know, mm-hmm. my aeronautical background. I had done a high pressure water cutting system where I developed this handheld, it's called a water router. One of the other spinoff companies from Flow Research became Flow International, Flow Systems, went by different names, and it was a separate company. And then I got involved in wind turbines, vertical axis wind turbines. Hmm. The initial thought was we would sell these turbines to, you know, third world countries where they didn't have electrical power in some areas. And so I was given the task of designing this turbine. And it was at a time when I think Ronald Reagan was president, and he had cut off a lot of the budgets to the research labs, but gave them a budget to transfer the technology to industry. So I went down and worked with Sandia because they had designed a lot of vertical axis wind turbines. And the idea with the vertical axis wind turbine is that all the heavy components are on the ground, so you don't need a crane to put them up. I was in charge of a group, and we designed this vertical axis wind turbine that kind of looked like a giant egg beater. And criteria for the design was that the whole turbine had to fit in a 40-foot long box, you know, a shipping container, and no component could be heavier than what could be carried on the back of an elephant. So it was an interesting design task. About 400 of them were put up in Outaman and Tehachapi Passes in California. So it was a very interesting project. And that's what the last thing I worked on. They moved that operation to California. I didn't want to go down. So I kind of left the company for about 9 months. And then I got a call from them that they were starting up this new company. They called it FlowJet initially, and then it became FlowMole, and then eventually Utilex. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to join because they had been working on a project for the Electric Power Research Institute, a group in Flow Research. And the Electric Power Research Institute had sponsored work with a few companies, and they were looking at developing a device that could replace cables without digging up the streets mm-hmm. and lawns, because they started to look at their data. When they initially started burying electrical cables, they thought they were going to last forever. But they soon found out, you know, that they're lasting about 20 years. Mm-hmm. They started to look at how the plant was put in the ground. And Lady Bird Johnson started a Beautify America program. And that Beautify America program, a major increase, an exponential increase in underground utilities. And so they saw, you know, knowing that they last about 20 years, the 20th anniversary of Beautify America was in the near future. And they started to panic about all the destruction that was going to happen to the environment because of the having to replace these cables. So they sponsored research to develop a device and that would be able to replace the cables. And that device became known as the cable follower. And that was a device that would cut the bad cable, slip the cable follower on there, and it used hydraulics to pull itself along. Mm-hmm. It had a spinning jet on the front that would excavate the soil around the cable. And when it got to the other end, they pull it all out and put with the new cable being pulled in. And that was the theory. The problem was that EPRI thought all the cables were installed according to their guidelines, where all the soil the cables were put in nice straight lines separated from other utilities. Because generally when they dug a trench, they put telephone, gas, everything that was, you know, they anticipated would be used. They put in the trench and they were supposed to be separated in layers within the trench. But oftentimes they weren't. They were all just thrown mm-hmm. in the trench. And I guess people figure that it's covered up, nobody will see it.
Right.
And so this backfill was also supposed to be sifted. So you take out all the rocks so you don't have any rocks laying on the cable. Well, most times, none of that happened. People would have an open trench and then lay the cables in, throw the old soil back on top. And sometimes, while the trench was open, they used it to dispose of different things. Like we found in New Jersey, an automatic transmission from a car sitting on the cable. And another place we found a refrigerator sitting on the cable. And so every time you encountered a rock or a refrigerator or an automatic transmission, you'd have to dig a pit and excavate that out and start the cable follower again. Not only that, but the cables they were replacing were cables that generally had failed two or three times. So they had splices in them. And each one of those splices, you'd have to dig it out and restart the cable follower. It was a very slow process. And I went to one of the sites where they were cable follower work, and it just looked like a war zone. It was excavation was just you know, potholes everywhere. It just did not look like a trenchless project that had, you know, minimum to surface caution to the service. Flow Mole was actually formed as a spinoff from Flow Research using a R&D limited partnership, and they raised like $10.5 million in 3 days. It was really amazing, because a lot of, you know, there was a lot of promise about what the cable follower could do and get the business going. And they had a concept for a device that could put cables underground without using other cables for guidance. Mm-hmm. And it was a very complicated hydraulic thing that in the ground that had actuators to move the head. It had a clamshell that expanded and pushed the thing forward so it would crawl through the. And when I came into Flow Mole, they already knew that concept was not viable. It wasn't going to work. So they asked me to come up with a new idea, something that would work. And that's basically how I got into this whole business. And I didn't have the background with the cable follower. The whole idea was the cable follower would be the main business until they could get another device going, you know, so that they could install separate cables rather than having to use the other cable.
So that was the guide drill that they developed?
It's the guide drill. You know, I came up with this idea. I knew the bent pipe. I kind of liked the idea. It seemed simple, and I like simple. But I knew the bent pipe wasn't going to work. So I thought what I need is a head that can rotate within the hole it's drilling without vibrating. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, look, why don't I use a, you know, make a contoured head? And so the head that I made was, the first one was, we called a banana head, because it was smooth all around. Because at the time, Flow Mole was promoting their equipment as not being capable of damaging other utilities in the ground. And in fact, they had done a lot of research on the high pressure water jets that they were using for excavating, cutting the soil, and showed that they really won't cut through the insulation of an electrical cable. And so they wanted the drill to be smooth, and so that if it rubbed against the cable, it wouldn't hurt it. Soon learned that smooth was not the best answer, and it was complicated to make. So we just made a cylindrical head and milled a bevel on the front end. And that's what eventually we just used, and it, with jets in the front end, and the jets helped excavate the soil, and the thing would spin and go in. We got the guide drill. I actually had the guide drill finished about a year ahead of schedule, and that was great, because the cable follower wasn't working so well with all the pits that they had to put in the ground.
What year was that?
It was, I think the guide drill first testing we did in 85. A year after I joined Flow Mole.
Yeah, can you describe it as like 1,600 pounds? It was so small.
Yeah, it was, you know, even I knew that the two-man drill motor, hydraulic motor, pushing it was not enough. So I knew that in addition to the head for guidance, we had to have a rig that could actually put more force on the drill. And that rig had about 1,600 pounds of thrust. And, you know, by today's standard, it's trivial. But it would cut into the soil. So I had the head, the rig, but I needed a way to determine where the head was so we knew how to steer it. So the first thing I tried was just, I knew that Bell Labs, I found out when I was working there, it's been about 20 years trying to develop a way of putting telephone cables underground and really didn't come up with a viable idea. But they had come up with a guidance system. So I looked at that and it was extremely complicated. And I thought, no, that doesn't seem right. And then I started to look at cable locating. That seemed to be a simple idea. So the first thing we tried was clamping transmitter for the cable locator over the drill pipe and then trying to find it. Well, a cable locator is designed to find a long wire in the ground. As you get to a kink in the wire or to the end of the wire, it completely falls apart. You can't really identify where it is. So I knew that wasn't by itself wasn't going to work, but I thought maybe if we had a different signal from the drill head than just the cable locating signal, maybe we could locate it with the cable locator. Mm-hmm. And that led me to the dipole transmitter, which we could make small enough to put into the head of the drill. Now, Flomo had no electronics lab or anything at the time, so I contracted out and found somebody who could make the transmitter for mm-hmm. me. And so we tried it. And sure enough, we could pinpoint exactly where the head was. The only issue with the cable locator then was that its depth calibration was made for a wire, not for mm-hmm. a dipole transmitter. So I made a chart because there was a one-to-one comparison. I could say when it says it's this deep on the cable locator, it's actually this deep with the dipole transmitter. And so then we could locate it. And I actually probably did the first drill run with that. I was out in front, you know, doing the drilling and, you know, somebody was on the drill rig. In those days, we thought all the information would be handled by the person with the locator, and the drill operator would just be responding to the commands from that person. And that's the way that drilling was for quite some time. But so I made the calls. We had developed a little computer program that we could practice calls and it would simulate what we were doing. And it worked. You know, there were some deficiencies in it, but we managed to, with training, mm-hmm. learn how to deal with it. First job we did where we took the equipment was into Lodi, California. Pacific Bell had a problem. They had a development that had rear lot installations on all the utilities. All the cables and stuff were underground in this rear lot. So you had two streets with homes on each street and then a lot between the homes, in the back of the homes. Nobody did anything to maintain the easements over the years. So the owners more or less claimed the easement. They put up a fence. And so there's a fence along the entire easement, then right in the middle of it, separating the homes on each street. And the cable was under this fence. Not only that, but once they had the fence up, the homeowners started to claim the land that was up to that fence. And so we found rock gardens, garages, and even a swimming pool that were over the easement. And so when the cable failed, the telephone cable failed, they didn't know what to do. So they stapled a cable to the fence and ran lines to all the pedestals along the way. And so we were in trying to find business. We found this fellow in Bell, Pacific Bell, was very interested in our work and became kind of a proponent for our work. And they decided to give us the most difficult job they had, which was replacing this cable, which was under the fence. And so we had a block that was about 750 feet long. And the most drill pipe we had was 400 feet. So we decided to go to one end of the block and drill from that. So we drilled little holes or potholes at each pedestal along the way. And we drilled from one end of the block through all the pedestal openings that we had created to the center pedestal on the block. And we pulled in the cable. Then we went around to the other end of the block and drilled to that center pedestal and pulled the other end of the cable in. And the hole was just like a lubricated conduit with the mud that we use for drilling. And we just reached down in the hole and pulled the cable up and then they hooked it to the pedestal. They were absolutely amazed that we could do something like that. Unfortunately, the phone company did not want to pay the price that we were charging for it. They're used to burying things relatively shallow, 18 inches at the time, and their budget wouldn't allow for it. So we didn't have any more phone work to do. But the next job we got was Pacific Gas and Electric in Gilroy. And that was an interesting job. There were two transformers on opposite sides of the street. And there was a cable, I guess it was 150, 200 feet long. With the advent of air conditioning, a lot of the electric power in established developments was not sufficient to power the air conditioners in the summer with the other demands. And so they were getting brownouts. And so they wanted to put in a bigger cable between the transformers. And I don't know if they upgraded the transformers as well, but the neighborhood was really concerned because they envisioned the street being torn up, people not being able to get out of their driveways, just a real mess. And we went in with our drill. We dug two little pits by the transformers to hook up. And we started behind the first pit, and we drilled all the way under the street to the second pit and came up. And in one day we were finished. And I know at one point during the drilling, some woman came out and the fellow was locating in her front yard. And she said, "What's he doing?" And I said, "Well, we're drilling. He's locating the drill." She said, "Where's the drill?" And I said, "Under where he's standing." And she couldn't believe that, you know, something was going on underground that we could monitor from the surface. At the end of the day, the electric company and the residents were all extremely, extremely grateful for what we had done.
How did you get involved specifically on the locating side of HGD and working on just that aspect of it? When you were at Flomol, I know you parted ways. I think you said like the late 80s, you parted ways with Flomol. But when did you get started on the locating side specifically and focusing on that?
Work developed the dipole transmitter. I knew that there was a lot of deficiencies in the cable locator. And so when I left Flomol, I decided that first off, I was going to develop a service drop drilling tool because Flomol wasn't involved in the short runs. So I got them to approve my business plan of a service drop drill with an advanced locator. I looked for investors. Basically, people's attitude was, this is construction. We don't invest in construction. It's low technology. I decided that, well, you know, I can at least get started on the locator because I could afford transistors and stuff, and I was working out of a spare bedroom in my house. And I knew from my experience, there were quite a few problems with the locating. One of them was that the drill head orientation, as we used on the Flomo equipment, keyed drill pipe. And the keyed drill pipe would essentially maintain the orientation of the drill head relative to the chuck on the drill rig. So that worked fine until we started to get out pretty much further in distance. And what would happen is the drill pipe would wrap up. Drill head was not in the same orientation as the chuck. So that was one major problem. The other major problem was the key coupling was a weak area on the pipe, and the pipe would break at that key. What they did at the time when they got out far was to use signal strength to determine when the drill was facing up, because there was a large window in the top of the drill with the signal out. And so the signal changed amplitude as you rotated the drill. So they rotate a few times, find where the peak was. And then let's say if it was at, that would be 12 o'clock, then they wanted to go to a 3 o'clock position. They'd give it another 90 degree turn, assuming the wrap up wouldn't change. Mm-hmm. So I knew that was a weakness. You know, first off, it would be nice to eliminate the key drill pipe. And secondly, it would be nice to have actual roll orientation of the head, so we didn't have to experiment around with, you know, play around trying to find what the orientation of the head was. So I knew on a new locator, I wanted to have roll being transmitted from the head. The other thing I knew was that it was very difficult to train an operator to hold the drill level in the ground. A new operator, their tendency would be to drill down. When they got to the right depth, they would start to level out. And by the time they leveled out, they were deeper than where they wanted to be. So they would steer up, and they do the same thing steering up, and they'd wind up too shallow. And they go back and forth this way, and sometimes the drill would come right out of the center of the street because they lost control of it. So I knew that if we had pitch on the drill, we would have a much better idea of where the drill was going, and it'd be a lot easier to train operators. Mm-hmm. The problem was, at the time, there was no pitch sensor that was independent of roll. So I had to invent one. And basically, I used parts around the house. I used plastic pipe caps, and piece of copper tubing, and a brass tube. And I made a little vessel and filled it with glycerin and salt water. And it worked. It gave me pitch. I could calibrate it to give me the pitch independent of the roll. I knew that those two things were solved. The other thing that we had a major problem with was the ghost signals that would come from a locator. Because of the single antenna, when you were locating the drill head, you actually got three peaks, one behind the drill head, one over the drill head, and one in front of the drill head. And you had to be sure that you were on the peak over the drill head, which was the strongest peak. If you wound up on the other peaks, you were either behind or ahead of the drill, and then the depth would be wrong when you read it on the locator. So you'd have the wrong location, the wrong depth. Well, I knew that was a function of that single, it was caused by that single antenna. And so I thought, if I could measure two components of the magnetic field by having two antennas at right angles to one another, that problem would go away. Designed the locator with that. And because I didn't need the separated antennas, I could make the box smaller, more compact. One other thing that the operators didn't like was that with a cable locator to get depth, you press the button and it would take data from one antenna for a period of time, switch to the other antenna, which was higher up in the locator, about 18 inches higher, and it would then ratio those two signal strengths and calculate a depth. Now, that was something they didn't like waiting for. They wanted instantaneous depth. So I figured if I made the transmitter so its signal strength remained constant regardless of the battery condition, which the old transmitters were not. As time went on, the batteries would get weaker and the signal would get weaker, and they couldn't measure the as deep because they were losing signal strength. So I thought, well, if I made the signal strength constant until the battery actually died, then I could use the signal strength itself and calibrate the signal strength and be able to show the depth continuously. And so I did that. I later wrote a paper on it because I showed that by doing the signal strength, calculating the depth from signal strength, depth was far more accurate. If the antennas are separated by a foot and a half, at a foot and a half, let's say you have a 2% accuracy in reading it. When you get down to 15 feet, 10 times as well, as deep, then that 2% accuracy jumps to 20%. And that's what some of the cable locator, people using cable locators to locate drills noticed that their accuracy was far less than whatever they got. That was a real bonus. And after I wrote the paper, other people started using it.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe the evolution of the HD locating system in general? I mean, from the rudimentary equipment that you worked with early on to the sophisticated equipment that's out there today?
Well, as I mentioned, the first equipment was just a cable locator. Then when other people started to get into HDD beside FloMo, there were locators that were brought out that were actually calibrated for a dipole transmitter, so you wouldn't need a chart. So you could read directly off the transmitter, off the receiver rather, what the depth was. And so that was the first step. Then I think some people eventually made the transmitter so it would shut off or turn on at 12 o'clock. So you'd spin it until it got to 12 o'clock. And when it got to 12 o'clock, the signal would come on, you knew it was 12 o'clock. We came out with a continuous reading of the roll orientation and the pitch orientation. So that was the next big step. And by the way, before, when I first got into this business, the terminology was azimuth elevation and tool face angle, taken from the oil drilling industry. Because of my aeronautical background, I changed it to yaw, pitch, and roll. And that terminology has stayed with the industry. I also, because of my aeronautical background, said that the drilling was really pterodynamics. And that didn't stick, but the all did. So anyway, we came out with the roll, pitch, orientation. And then eventually we added temperature and battery status to it so the locator could read that. Then we came out with, some people came out with remote displays. Then we came out with a remote display that actually had a homing feature to it so that we could lay our locator on its side on the ground and the drill operator could see left, right, how to steer, get the tool to go under the box where it was laying on the ground. And so that was a big thing. People could actually lay the box ahead of the drill and use pitch to hold the drill level. Then we introduced new features using essentially the shape of the magnetic field instead of just the strength of the field. So we determined their locate points ahead and behind the drill where the magnetic field was coming out of the surface vertically. And we called them locate points. We had a little plus minus sign on the locator and taught operators how to use those two points, because it was much more precise than finding the signal strength of the head, particularly as they were going deeper. Because initially, people were drilling telephone at 18 inches, power at 3 feet, and then fiber optics started to be put into the ground. They required cement caps above and below. And we kind of said, why do you need that? We can go deep enough that somebody isn't going to be digging that deep. And so people started drilling deeper to put in things like fiber optics. And then they started drilling deeper to avoid the things that were already in the ground. So it kept getting deeper. When we started the business, I think the locators would go down about 10 feet. And I think our first locator went down 16. And then it's gradually evolved, going down to 100 feet or more.
It's amazing.
It's, yeah. After we came up with, some of these other improvements, in 2000, we came up with the Eclipse locator. And there, what we used is the more of the field orientation from the dipole transmitter. We used that to create a screen. It was like a radar screen, and it would show where the locate point was relative to where the operator was standing. So no longer did they have to move the locator back and forth and step around.
Right.
They could walk directly to the locate point. And that was a huge, huge improvement, really sped up the operation. You know, it's kind of evolved that way. And the latest things we're dealing with are noise. Backgrounds, with electrical transformers and cables in the ground, and there's electrical noise that interferes with the signal. And it became a huge problem in China, because I think there are fewer restrictions on the equipment they put on electrical lines. So they create more noise in the ground. And we first came up with a two frequency transmitter that you could change frequencies from one to the other to try and get a better signal. You know, one frequency worked one part of the run, a different frequency in another part of the run. But eventually we needed more. So we came up with the Falcon series, and the Falcon is the lightest series, and it uses hundreds of frequencies. Mm-hmm. And so the operator can walk the bore path and get a presentation of what the noise looks like in different areas. And then they can pick a couple of frequencies to program the transmitter and the locator to those frequencies, so they can use the two best frequencies that would run in there. That's been a major, major accomplishment for dealing with noise. We also wanted to work better under streets with rebar reinforcement. The higher the frequency, the more rebar interferes with the signal. So we came up with the sub-K transmitters, very low frequency transmitters, and the signal goes right through the rebar. So we can do major highways and runways without interference and other places where there's a lot of metal in the ground.
I mean, it's amazing how far the technology has come in the last 25 years or so since you started DCI. How would you describe today's HDD market?
I think the market has suffered a setback because of the coronavirus. The demand hasn't necessarily gone down, but what's happened is that some of the municipalities have, cut back on on services they provide. And so approvals of some jobs have taken more time than usual. But it hasn't been that bad. But one of the things I think the virus has done, it showed the need for more connectivity. The internet as it stands now is not sufficient. There's not enough people connected to it. People are needed to work from home, and they needed probably more bandwidth than they have. I know where I live, I only have 5 megahertz. I mean, it's considered nothing anymore, you know. It's been that way for 20 years. It was good when it first came in, but it hasn't changed. Yeah. So we have schooling at home. We have people working from home. People being at home use the internet for entertainment more. So I think it's created an awareness that we have to do more. We have to get it into the rural areas. We got to bolster the areas that have, you know, subpar service. I think all that. So I think there's a very bright future, just the internet alone. And the other thing that's always bothered me is I've gone to somebody's home and they have this great view out their window, except for this utility pole with a dozen wires hanging off of it. You know, I just, you know, I look at it and I say, you know, it kind of reminds me of the song, it just doesn't have to be that way, you know? And I know it's a upfront expense for the utility companies, but in the long run, it saves them money. Mm-hmm. Storms take down those lines.
You do hear more and more about the overhead lines being put underground because of storm damage as a primary.
Yeah. What's happened is that, you know, like in our house, we're kind of in a more remote area, and we probably have 3 or 4 power outages a year. And they keep putting the same lines up. You know, at one point they had this program to underground all their wiring. And then the 2008 recession hit, and they sort of dropped it. And I was talking to one of the fellas from the electric company the other day, and he said, oh, they solved the problem. They have better insulation on the line. He was assuming the problem comes when a branch touches the line and shorts things out. But it's not the branch. It's the tree coming down, the line down. That's the real problem, you know. And it's a shame they haven't gone back to the program of undergrounding their whole plant.
Yeah. I mean, you're obviously very passionate about the HGD and locating. So what is it about all this that has kept you involved all these years? And I mean, you're a young man. What are you still doing today? What are you working on today?
Well, actually, Peter Hambling and I, Peter's my partner, I've kind of stepped aside, and we let my son, Matt, and his oldest son, Colin, take over the business. We're not uninvolved. We, you know, we read our daily emails. I occasionally throw in an idea or two to kind of move things in the direction I think it should go. But Peter has a World War II bomber that he likes to fly around, and I have a helicopter I like to fly around, and we both have airplanes that we, you know, small planes that we fly, and I'm building an airplane and using my aeronautical background to redesign the thing, and we keep busy.
That's pretty cool. The World War II plane, a helicopter. I mean, you guys are going like back and forth on who has what. He's building the plane. You're building a plane.
Yeah.
What do you think's ahead for the directional drilling industry going forward? You think good times ahead for them? I mean, I know it's all cyclical. We get that. Any kind of industry is cyclical, but they always talk about directional drilling being, there's two sides of it. There's the pipeline river crossing aspect of the industry, and then there's the telecom utility fiber industry. What do you see, what future do you see for both of those?
Well, it's interesting. Over the years, I've noticed that some of the big rigs have gotten a little bit smaller. They've been smaller. And some of the small rigs have gotten bigger. And so while there was that division at one time, it's more of a spectrum from small rigs to big rigs. You know, it's just gone that way. And so that, you know, there's just a range of things that they're undergrounding now, and they need different size rigs for different applications. The introduction of the two pipe rock drilling to replace the mud motor was a big, I think, step forward. The automatic loading of drill rod was a big step forward that made the handling the heavy pipe a lot easier. And it also was safer because it was very easy to get someone hurt moving those big pipes around. So I think there's an evolution. I think there's automation is going to come in soon, and people are going to start to take some of the human process out of there, make it more automatic. There's always going to be a need for human decision. You know, there are some things that don't have to be done manually that can be done automatically. So I think it's ever going to evolve. We're going to do our best to keep evolving the locators, and the drill manufacturers are going to keep evolving the drills.
Well, we'll have to see what the next 50 years holds for directional drilling. I'm sure you'll still be here working away.
Well, I hope so. Yeah.
Well, that wraps up another Torrentials Technology podcast. I want to thank John Mercer for joining me today and sharing his stories. To learn more about all the goings on in the Torrentials world, as well as HDD turning 50, check out our latest issue of Torrentials Technology. You can find it in your mailbox, inbox, or online at torrentialstechnology.com.
This has been a Torrentials Technology podcast. To hear more of my conversations about the Torrentials industry, go to torrentialstechnology.com/podcast.